Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, the UGA researcher who has changed vaccine recommendations around the world.
And as a result of our presentation, the WHO now recommends universal introduction of rubella-containing vaccine.
Plus, a local author celebrates the launch of her third novel on Irish immigrants in America.
The BBC World Service.
What's going on here?
We get to the heart of global issues.
Stories we think matter from around the world.
Everything was there in a way that I'd never heard before.
Discussing the very best in global arts and culture.
What has been happening on the financial markets today?
Storytelling is something we absolutely love.
Everyone's voice is so unique.
Wow.
It's a celebration.
The BBC World Service.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. Rubella causes tens of thousands of cases of birth defects a year. Yet, until 2024, the World Health Organization did not recommend the distribution of the vaccine in 19 countries. Dr. Amy K. Winter is a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics in the College of Public Health at the University of Georgia. Her recent research, modeling the implementation of the rubella vaccine, led the World Health Organization to recommend introduction of the vaccine around the world. Dr. Winter sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss her groundbreaking findings. Here's their conversation.
Can you tell us a little bit about congenital rubella syndrome and how rubella spread?
Rubella infection is generally very mild, particularly when children get it. The problem is that when pregnant women become infected with rubella, it can lead to serious outcomes, including stillbirth, miscarriage, or the birth of a child with congenital rubella syndrome, or CRS. And CRS is marked by a triad of birth defects that usually include heart defects, eye problems, and deafness.
So it's pretty serious.
Yeah, it's estimated there's about 100,000 CRS cases annually. The reality is that the burden has dropped a lot because of rubella-containing vaccine, which has been implemented in the vast majority of countries. And there's only about 19 countries who have yet to implement or have rubella-containing vaccine available into their public sector healthcare system.
And so your recent research models what would happen if the rubella vaccine were introduced in these countries where the vaccine is not yet a part of the regular schedule. So can you talk a little bit about why the rubella vaccine isn't administered in some countries?
So there's been this World Health Organization guidance since the year 2000 that suggests that countries should not introduce the rubella-containing vaccine unless they can confirm that 80% of each birth cohort can be vaccinated. And this guidance is well-founded. It's based on a lot of original modeling work done in the 1980s and 1990s. And it identifies what we call in the field a rubella childhood vaccination paradoxical effect, which means that if you vaccinate children at suboptimal levels, you can actually make the burden worse. You can actually create more CRS cases. And this results because when you vaccinate children at suboptimal levels, you actually increase the average age of infection. So now instead of becoming infected at 5 years old, now you're going to become infected maybe closer to 10 years old. So you can imagine that pushes the whole entire susceptible population into older ages, which results in more pregnant women being at risk of CRS or having rubella infection, and then having a baby born with CRS. So because of this rubella paradoxical effect, where if you vaccinate children at suboptimal levels, you can actually result in more CRS cases, countries haven't been able to introduce the vaccine yet. But over the years, we've been sort of chipping away at that 80% vaccination coverage. That's the threshold that's been set. And if you don't hit that, then you shouldn't introduce the vaccine. But the scientific body has really been chipping away at the relevance of that 80% coverage threshold with the general consensus that it's too conservative.
And that 80%, that's for measles vaccination.
So the 80% is ultimately for rubella vaccination, but you're correct. We look to the measles vaccine to determine if when the rubella vaccine is added to the measles vaccine, they'll be able to hit the 80% coverage threshold. So countries look to their current measles vaccination coverage to determine if the 80% vaccination coverage would be met once the rubella vaccine is added.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the countries that have not introduced the rubella vaccine?
Yeah, they're 19 countries. They're mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, and they make up actually about 10% of the global population, including Nigeria and DRC. So it's a lot of big countries, and ultimately it's this WHO guidance of this 80% vaccination coverage threshold has resulted in kind of leaving that 10% of the population a little bit behind without access to this vaccine.
And can you tell us a little bit about your research and what you concluded?
We conducted scenario modeling as a part of the measles and rubella partnership, myself leading the rubella transmission model at the University of Georgia, and a colleague, Amelia Benecke, leading a rubella model at UK Health Security Agency. And what we did is we conducted a bunch of simulations to determine what happens under different vaccine scenarios. We looked at 18 different vaccine scenarios that included introducing the rubella vaccine at different coverage levels, as well as using different campaign effects. So we looked at what if they had, when they introduced the vaccine, they also vaccinated every single individual in the country up to 14 years old, which is pretty recommended and standard. What if they went and set up to 5 years old? And then what if they had different coverage levels between 80%, or sorry, 60% and 90%? So what we did is conducted the scenario modeling of these 19 scenarios where we simulated rubella transmission. And from each of those scenarios, we determine what's the impact of that vaccination strategy. Ultimately, what we found is that 80% vaccination coverage is indeed too conservative, and that countries who use the recommended WHO vaccination schedule, which includes adding rubella vaccine to the measles vaccine in their routine program, in addition to what we call a catch-up campaign, which is before the vaccine is added to routine, you vaccinate every single person in the country up to 14 years old, and then followed by what we call follow-up campaigns, which is every 5 or so years, a country will again vaccinate everyone in the country up to 4 years old. And that's the WHO recommended schedule. And based on that recommended schedule, we found that no countries are actually at risk of this paradoxical effect, and that CRS burden is both going to decline at the cumulative across 30 years. And there also is minimal risk that there would be any ever an increase in CRS in a given year.
Can you talk a little bit about the impacts of the study on global vaccine policy recommendations?
We conducted all this scenario modeling at the University of Georgia, and we worked with the Measles and Rubella Partnership, which included colleagues from US CDC, the Gates Foundation, and others. And we put together a presentation of about 2 hours in order to bring to WHO Strategic Advisory Group of Experts for a recommendation for the universal introduction of rubella-containing vaccine to the remaining 19 countries. So this work was conducted in the middle of 2024, and it was in September of 2024 that we went to WHO SAGE and presented the work. And as a result of our presentation, the WHO now recommends universal introduction of rubella-containing vaccine, which means that the last 19 countries will now have access for Gavi subsidies in order to introduce the vaccine.
What about here in the U.S. And in Georgia? Is rubella eliminated here?
Yeah, as a country, we don't have to worry too much about rubella. And the reality is that it's because the rubella vaccine is safe and so effective. Two doses of rubella-containing vaccine is effective up to 95%. I'm sorry, 97%. So as a result, yeah, we haven't had to worry about rubella too much in this country because we've been able to eliminate it and maintain elimination.
All right. Well, Dr. Amy Winter, thank you so much for your time. This has been fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Amy K. Winter is a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics in the College of Public Health at the University of Georgia. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA.
I'm Tanya Mosley. There's so much news that it's hard to keep up, and many of those stories break in the middle of the day. Here and Now covers the news when you need it, so you're in the know.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. Ireland has captured many writers' hearts, including that of local author Lyra Rhodes. Early this year, she will release her third novel on the experience of Irish immigrants in Georgia. Tybee Rhapsody will be released on January 16th at Hendershot's from 7 to 9 p.m. Rhodes is also an emerita professor of journalism at the Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication and sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss her novel. Here's their conversation.
So something that struck me about Tybee Rhapsody, your new book, is the precision that you use in the language and the research. Where it really struck me was how you work in the definition of the word rhapsody. So what does rhapsody mean for our listeners, and why did you choose to structure your book around this type of composition?
First of all, rhapsody is a free-form music composition, so that it can be any kind of spirit, any kind of movement, as long as you understand music and can do something. I see it as a free-form poem. And since I'm talking so much in the book about creativity, I wanted to bring that in. The power of the story is that she creates her music based on the creative process. And I think the rhapsody fits in tremendously with that creative process.
Can you tell us a little more about the main character, Gertrude, and the journey she goes on?
Gertrude wanted to be, all her life, a concert pianist. However, she's from an Irish immigrant community where a nursing program was set up that made it an opportune time for her to be a nurse and have a career where she could take care of herself rather than some, as her family said, pie in the sky musician. But she still played and practiced and did a recital in the book, The Darkest Midnight in December. She was Sharon, the protagonist of that book, best friend in that book. And so she was so strong to me as a character, as a secondary character, that I thought she needs her own book. She needs to tell her story of how music is so important to her, but it's almost impossible for her to reach that goal in 1906 in Savannah, Georgia, that she needed to branch out, she needed to find some ways, and she does in Tybee Island.
She deals with this outdated view that women have a, quote, inability to create, but she has this inner yearning to compose music. And yet this attitude is ingrained in her, and she has to find a way to overcome it. What's made you turn from your first book, which was about an Irishman's struggle to succeed in America, squarely to women's experiences, given that your last book was also about a woman confronting her social role?
That's interesting. I never thought about it that way. I look at writing the book as, what issue does the character say to me? And in the second novel, Gertrude had a very strong interest, and I have a strong interest in creativity. And so it was a perfect avenue for doing that. And there's a lot in current events. There's a lot in history that we need to remember, that it has not been easy for immigrants and women to survive in any country in the world, so that you have to work twice as hard, three times as hard, to be even recognized. And sometimes that doesn't even happen.
So in the book, Gertrude travels to several different towns, as you hinted. She begins in Dublin. The book begins in Dublin, but she's from Savannah. She goes to Galway. She goes to Tybee. What did you consider while writing about your character's ability to move from place to place?
She was on a quest. And so I wanted to visually show that quest as far as mentally, about her moving around and being able to find a location. She went to Kirkpatrick because that's a very Catholic Irish thing to do for penance. She was looking for answers. She was looking for direction. What she does all the way through the book is try to find the direction of her life. It was a very confusing time for her. And in that confusion, she also had to deal with the idea of loneliness and solitude. And that's why I bring in Thoreau, because I think he was introducing a lot of those same thoughts of how one can create isolation as solitude, but someone else could interpret it as loneliness. And I've wrestled with that.
And can you talk a little bit more about the difference between those two in terms of their connotation?
Well, I have to do it just simply from my own personal examination of all the literature that I've read. Loneliness is just a borderline depression of not feeling good within oneself. Solitude is being in the same place, but being okay with it, being fine with it. In fact, looking for it in order to be able to create. So I have crossed that line. I've gone from loneliness to solitude. I seek out those places of quiet so that I can work, that I can write, that I can think, that I can create.
And can you tell us a little bit about the reception of your novels by the Irish and the Irish heritage community here in Athens, or here in Georgia?
Well, actually, it's the United States. The Celtic Heritage Foundation, they have recommended the books, which means a stamp of authority that I'm doing my research, that I'm looking at it and putting things together that talks about what is heritage rather than culture. Things that are passed on, things that families pass on, the culture that's passed on can be part of the heritage.
And so you will have a book launch on January 16th, 2026. What can people expect?
People can expect a good time because Fonny Rigg, the local Irish band here with Nathan Peters as the leader, is going to play Irish songs written before 1900.
Lyra Rhodes, thank you so much for your time. This has been wonderful.
Thank you.
Lyra Rhodes is an emerita professor of journalism at the Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication. She has written three novels as part of her Remembering Ireland series, published with Old Fort Press. This week on the Georgia Health Report, studies show that veterinarians are at higher risk for developing mental health issues. What are some ways both veterinarians and their patients' caregivers can address the issue? WUGA's Emma Auer sat down with Noelle Browning, a clinical counselor at the University of Georgia's Veterinary Teaching Hospital. She works with both pet parents and the students and vets that take care of their animals. Here's their conversation.
Can you tell us about some of the unique challenges that veterinarians face when it comes to their mental health?
We face things like moral distress. Sometimes we're asked to keep animals alive longer than we think maybe they should be because they're struggling or suffering. Maybe we're asked to euthanize too soon, that we think that the animal still has great quality of life. That is moral distress. Veterinarians also face things like client transfer burden, which is where just the daily, you know, interactions with clients can be exhausting over time. It's a cumulative kind of effect. And things like non-adherence to treatment plans and confrontations, cyberbullying online.
And what do you tell student veterinarians and veterinarians about how to maintain their own mental health?
So that is a conversation that I have pretty frequently. I do some lectures on this, and we talk about how to cope with compassion fatigue, being able to identify compassion fatigue triggers. But in addition to that, identifying compassion satisfaction triggers, things that make you feel good about the work that you're doing, being able to ground yourself in your professional purpose, like, why am I doing the work that I do, right? Being able to kind of reground yourself, being able to identify your personal identity and say, this is what everybody sees about me, but I know who I am inside. So maybe I'm a great person. I'm very honest. I care deeply about animals. I try really hard. Those type of things, if you're familiar with yourself enough and knowing who you are, then what can happen is maybe you're faced with some of those client challenges where people are angry or telling you they only care about money, which does happen. And you can say, you know what, I kind of know who I am. And I know that you're going through a lot of stress. And so that's the way you're expressing it. But I'm a great person and I try really hard. And I'm here because I love animals and I want what's best for them.
What role on the other side can families and individuals play during their interactions with veterinarians?
So great question. And I appreciate that question. I think that it's very important to kind of understand that the work that you do when you're with your doctors in the human medical field is very similar to what we do in vet med. And so be able to kind of use your human experiences to set some expectations for veterinary medicine. Being kind to veterinarians is important. You know, coming in with a list of questions so that you know what to talk about. Understanding that there is a limited amount of time to work with the veterinarians.
And then finally, how can veterinarians out there in Georgia get help if they need it?
So there are some really great organizations. One of them is called Vets for Pets and People. They have support groups. They've got hotlines. We also have our suicide support hotline, 988. Don't forget also just our colleagues when we're talking and seeing changes in the people around us to have those conversations. Don't be afraid that you're going to overstep a boundary.
Noelle Browning, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. This week's show was produced by Emma Auer. If you missed a portion of this broadcast, Athens News Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at WUGA.org. And will be rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. As always, thanks for listening and stay with WUGA throughout the week for the latest in-depth local news.